Through. Look, I really would like to hear from anybody that may have been to the community nursery in Mount Gambier. Ken Baker is here, and we'll talk to him very shortly about it's opened not so very long ago, and we'll see how it's going. But also joining us today is Mark Backman, who is the manager of Nature Glenelg Trust. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Stan.
Now, Ken, sorry, I'll come back to you, Ken. Told you I had no structure. We'll come back to you, Ken, to talk about the garden, but I want to talk about some money coming, well, your way, I suppose, Mark.
Yes, Stan, we had some good news earlier in the week with the State Environment Minister in South Australia announcing the community environment grants for South Australia, and these are medium-sized grants, up to $30,000, and can be run over a 12-month period, and we're lucky enough to have three projects funded.
And they are?
There's a project looking at bat diversity and the composition of bat communities in the mid-southeast.
In the mid-southeast, because there's a fair bit done Narracourt and north, isn't there?
There is, and one of the species actually that we're hoping to pick up with this survey work is the southern bentwing bat, which does occur in the Narracourt caves, but does use quite a wide area around the caves. Obviously, they concentrate there over the summer in the maternity cave when they're breeding, but obviously they need to find food year-round. So.
But would one find its way down here?
And they certainly do.
They do and go back. I mean,
Not necessarily that far over the summer when they're breeding. The trips to and from the maternity cave, I think, are somewhere in the order of up to 100 k's, that sort of thing. So it's
extraordinary.
Or it might not be quite that, maybe 50 k's. They did actually do some radio tracking a couple of years ago, and the numbers escaped me, the exact numbers, but I know they were surprised at how far some of those trips were.
Yeah.
And it was particularly related on how far bats had to go to, concentrated points for feeding over wetlands, things like that, where you get a high density of insects.
Mm.
But in the overwintering period, when the bats disperse, they certainly use habitat all around the region for feeding and for sheltering, and it's that time of the year when they disperse and will be found hanging out in caves all around the region because they're a cave-dwelling bat.
But do they hibernate as such in the cold weather? Or?
I think they can go into short phases of low activity, but generally they're high turnover animals. They've got to be out feeding whenever they can, and in past years there's been surveys happen to see where the bats are in the overwinter period, and they're certainly down in the caves in this part of the world, and there's a few people out there in the community that have been involved in those surveys because we needed volunteer help when they've happened in the past.
Mm-hmm.
The bat project will be looking at trying to particularly feed information into a much larger project that the state environment agency down here, DUNA, or the Department for Environment, Water and Natural Resources, are managing a revegetation project up in that area north of Narracourt. And so the aim with this small grant that we'll be managing is to collect some information about working in partnership with landowners that are interested.
And what involvement would you want from them to sort of keep their eye out?
Well, one of the things we were hoping to do with this project is give them the opportunity to help participate in collecting the information. There's a remote recording means by which you can detect what bats are in an area. So as well as doing the obvious setting up what's called mist nets and actually capturing bats and seeing what's about in that way, there's also another method for surveying for bats, which is to set up a device called an anabat recorder.
An anabat?
It actually records the calls. Their bat calls are quite specific frequencies and patterns. When you look at them on a screen, you know how you see a sound wave on a screen.
Yes.
Each bat's call is... There's a couple that are very close, but most of them are distinguishable from each other. And so very clever people out there have managed to come up with means of taking that data and processing it through a program so you don't have to sit there and listen to it, and actually coming up with the results of what species were calling in that particular period. So one of the ways that landowners up that way will be able to participate, if they're interested, would be for us to put an anabat recorder on their property. And for then that information to be fed in and process so that we can see what bats are up there. And what I guess the interesting thing will be to see what bats are using which habitats, and then that information can feed into a longer-term project that the department are running down here where they'll be trying to revegetate in that landscape. So the idea is, and this is really a theme for us, I guess, as an organisation, is to find these strategic ways we can fill an information gap and then use that information to feed into a bigger picture program or
yeah, so that priority. We can provide the environment that they need to
exactly, yeah.
survive.
So,
in.
So that's the first of the grants. The next one that's worth mentioning is a project focusing on the Yarra pygmy perch, and this is a fish that most people would be unaware of because they're not a species that are large enough to be considered a target species for recreational anglers. They're only literally
pretty small fish, aren't they?
Yeah, I guess the term pygmy gives it away. But the Yarra pygmy perch is in real look. They've been in real strife in the region. They're a what we call an obligate freshwater species. They need permanent aquatic or freshwater habitat to survive. And obviously, while drainage activities across the region have been good at opening up the landscape for agricultural development, it has meant that for species like our native fish, it's restricted the number of places that are capable of sustaining them in the landscape. And even though there's a lot of water, people notice this time of year, it gets wet through the winter, swamps fill up. We don't have anywhere near the number of permanent swamps that we used to have. So when it comes to the end of summer, autumn, when you drive around and you notice there's not much water around anywhere, these fish actually need habitat to tide. If you're a fish, you can't be a fish out of water. You've got to have
fish
water.
Out of water. So they just die, do they?
In fact, there are places where, because of the long-term drying trend in the region, certainly seen places that particularly in the last 5 or 6 years when the drought was at its worst and there are still places that are suffering in this way where we've had landowners in certain parts of the region say to us, I've never seen this, first time in living memory, which really means forever, that site's ever dried out. Mm. And some of these places are important patches where we had known that there were species of fish like Yarra pygmy perch or another case study, I guess, south of Mount Gambier, down in the springs along the coast, we have the spiny crayfish, and that's another species that requires permanent freshwater habitat. We have a few of these specialist species in the region, and the reason the Yarra pygmy perch is a good example is it's a species that we first learned about in the region when Michael Hammer first started coming down and doing survey work about 12 years ago.
Yes.
And even in that 10-year period, because we then entered into a drought phase, we really saw quite a serious decline in its distribution and abundance. And it was only a limited species in extent before then because the amount of available habitat is quite limited anyway. But, we're down to a situation now where there's only literally 5 sites in the region where the species still occurs. And
yeah, because it's unlike a bird that can fly to better spots. It can't go very far, can it?
Exactly. Yeah, that's right. And in fact, the drainage network itself has become a refuge of sorts for fish and frogs, because you can imagine you impose drains in the landscape. They do their primary function of draining swamps and moving water off the land. Then they become the lowest points in the landscape. Mm. And in fact, a really important place for the Yarra pygmy perch and one of its strongholds is a site on Drain M itself, in the drain. So, and we're fortunate that the Drainage Board in Millicent are actually extremely supportive of trying to do what we can to make sure that the management of that site is
sustainable. But being a freshwater fish, it wouldn't want to go all the way down that drain, would it? It would end up in the sea.
That's right. So they won't. Some species of fish in the region do actually spend time in both the sea and freshwater, like eels, for example. But Yarra pygmy perch is a freshwater species only. And one of the ways that they disperse and would have historically dispersed in between drier phases was when the landscape flooded and there was connectivity all through. And the drains themselves now provide some of that connectivity. But we've got a few challenges for this species, but fortunately there has been a little bit of work done already with the support of the department down here. We've been working with them on some of the background for this species, and there's been, during the drought phase, there were fish taken into captivity, and there were programs set up with Millicent High School and with Kingston Community School, and fantastic to see this opportunity to join up, I suppose, a very real threatening process for a species of fish out there in the real world with an educational opportunity for kids in the school environment.
You also got some money for the up-close community events, which I'll talk to you about shortly. Mark Backman is our guest this morning from Nature Glenelg Trust, and also Ken Baker is here from the Community Nursery Project. Last time I spoke to you, Ken, you hadn't quite opened.
No, we're just about to open later on that morning.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How did all that go?
Oh, fantastic. We had a good turnout. I think throughout the day we had about 100 people from both Victoria and different parts of South Australia. So, yeah.
So where are you up to now? What activities are you undertaking there?
Well, at the moment we're still, while the nursery, the major part of the nursery has been built and all the rest of it, we're setting up propagation facilities, and at the moment I'm constructing a greenhouse.
So a glass one?
No, it's polycarbonate, which is supposed to be just as good as glass.
Do they still make glass greenhouses?
Yes, they do.
They do.
But they're more expensive.
Yeah.
But yeah, I had fun setting that up yesterday.
Is that...
At my stage, I had to stand behind it and hold it up
course.
While the storm came through.
With the hail and everything. And you were close to where the cyclists were doing their thing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
This, what do you call it,
It's a polycarbonate.
Polycarbonate. It's like in a sheet form that you pull over, or is it a...
No, you slot it in. The frame is such that you can just slot it in. It's 10 mil thick polycarbonate. So that's supposed to provide the same sort of insulation properties as glass.
Is it opaque or is it transparent?
It's transparent, yes.
No.
Yeah. So that'll be good. We'll be able to propagate a few more things, conduct a few more trials. And
Such as? What are you propagating? Remind me.
At the moment... I've propagated things like vanilla lilies, and there's various types of mints, and there's a whole range of.
So where are they likely to end up?
Some of I've grown for an ecologist up at Narracourt, Peter Tucker. Things like the lilies are not that hard to germinate, but you have to keep them in the nursery for a couple of seasons before they're big enough. And that's, for most nurserymen, that's not a commercially viable proposition. So that's one of the reasons we have them growing. So it's not all sort of necessarily hard to grow species or hard to germinate species.
No.
But species that are not making their way into revegetation mixes because they're just not commercially viable to grow.
To grow. Yeah. And do you have your disappointments?
I haven't been there long enough to have any great disappointments.
It's a bit early yet, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I don't think anything you learn. I mean, that's the whole thing. I'm really looking forward to... part of my role is to trial 40 species that are difficult to germinate. And I won't be doing that all myself. What I'm doing is enlisting. I'm in the process now. That's one of the exciting things I'm doing now, is enlisting various growers as well as research organisations like... The South Australian Seed Conservation Centre, just trying to line them up to do some trials. And, we're on the way to doing that at the moment.
But when you say trialling, I mean, if something fails, there are a thousand, well, I don't know how many, many reasons why that particular plant has failed.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, and what we're trying to do is sort of, conduct the experiments or the germination trials in such a way that you can sort of reduce a lot of the background noise, if you will. So you're never going to be certain. Under laboratory conditions like the Seed Conservation Centre, you can conduct very tightly controlled experiments and all the rest of it, but they're very expensive. And that's the reason we don't have knowledge on a lot of these plants that are desired to be in revegetation projects, but they're not. They're just not available, and there's not the research. There's a real paucity of research on these. They're expensive. A lot of the organisations are under-resourced in the
first
place.
But you need a lot of patience, Ken. I mean, I admire you because I think you are a very patient person. I mean, I'd plant something today and want to see it tomorrow coming out of the ground,
Yeah.
I can't stand this. Oh, you might have to wait a month or 6 weeks.
Oh, well, some of them you have to, there's some require an after-ripening period of a year or more, sometimes 2 years,
Really?
Before you can actually begin to start the germination process. So, it can be it's a long-term trial. Well, what we're hoping to do with this project is to set up the skills and the knowledge within the community so it can be carried on by interested people. So we're not only working with the boffins, so to speak, but we're also, working on increasing the capacity of growers to do that. We've got a few dollars to help them along the way, to spend a bit more time on germination trials.
And so, are people popping in to sort of say, what are you doing? Do the people
Yeah, they often do. People are very curious because we're in a very central location there.
Of course you are, yeah.
People sort of peering through the gate on the recreation side or on the park side. So,
yeah. Mark, more money coming your way for the delivery of a new series of biodiversity up close programs.
That's right.
What are they?
Well, hopefully many of your listeners will be aware that over the first well, actually, starting in the autumn, but Becky started on the program back in the last summer. We ran a series of events, which concluded at the end of June, that Becky was coordinating. And this is basically a repeat of, allows us to come back and do the same thing again next year. So the same source of funding. I guess we'd like to think that the huge success that we had last time is one of the reasons why that they've come back and funded us to work on this again next year. So I guess the good news for people who are listening that, that came along to any of the events that Becky ran through the August, through the autumn just past, that next year we'll be running a similar program. Similar. And I say similar because each year the aim is to tackle a range of new environmental issues and bring people up close to them. So that often involves an element where people will hear about an issue by coming along to presentations in town here or in other locations around the region. Or actually, we had quite a few partner activities that happened out in the field. So,
We had some wonderful
topics. Fungi and dawn chorus. And, you know, these were things we did this year. Yeah. Next year, look, if people have got ideas they're particularly fond of or would like to see us tackle next year, then they're certainly welcome to look us up on the website and send an email through, because we're always interested to try and meet people's interests when we run these
programs.
So
will this be in the summer months or a bit later in the year, like last year?
Yeah, we'll probably aim to do it at a similar time to last year.
Yeah.
And actually the other thing, Stan, just to mention to finish off on Yarrapingi Perch, because I think I forgot to tell you what we're actually going to do with the grant, but the grant funding for the Yarrapingi Perch will allow us to do some genetic analysis on those five populations and also fish that have been taken into captivity. And that information will then be fed in to allow us to decide how those fish that have been brought into captivity could be best used. Now that the region has wetted up a little bit compared to where it was a few years ago, we have the possibility of reintroducing fish to some sites to try and, rather than just sitting back and watching this species decline, to actually try and nudge them back in the other direction. A key site for that we're hoping to have a positive response at is the restored wetland down at Piccaninny Ponds, Pick Swamp. So that's
just an
example.
Is that job finished now, Piccaninny Ponds?
It is actually, yeah. There's there's been a series of stages of works going on there. The most recent work to reconnect the eastern and western wetland was completed by the department recently, and obviously the recovery process now, from an environmental sense, just keeps on trickling on, and obviously
it's like the Berlin Wall has been taken down, isn't it?
Exactly. There was the road was acting as a barrier there between the two sides, and it's for species of fish and all those other things that are in the water itself. Now there's this opportunity to move again through the system, which is fantastic. That's what nature is all about.
Mark Backman from Nature Glenelg Trust. Ken Baker, just back to you briefly. When we talk about propagation and the sort of work that you do, I'm thinking of you start off with a seed or a seedling and eventually it grows into a plant of about yay high. What about native grasses? Are you involved in any of that?
We do have a few samples of native grasses that we might be trialling here. But there are other people out there who have a lot more experience and are set up to trial those species. There's one guy I'm thinking of over in Hamilton, because we work across the border as well, and he has seed production areas set up where he tries. It's like someone growing wheat, but he grows grassland plants, including grasses.
Yeah, because they have become very popular in commercial nurseries, and people are starting to put them in. Not starting, they've been doing it for a while. Put them in their own gardens.
Yeah. A lot of that sort of work is done, is direct seeded.
Yeah. All right. So what's ahead of you? Well, you've already told me what's ahead of you. And let's just locate where the nursery is.
It's in Vansittart Park and just near the scoreboard, mm-hmm. If you're on the recreation side. It's next to where Dan, the gardener, the guy that looks after Vansittart Park's lock-up is there.
So. Yeah. Easy to find. Go and say hello to Ken.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Mark, thank you.
Thank you very much, Stan. Lovely to see you again.
Keep up the good work.